The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
We just had the best year that the auto industry has had in a long time. I voted to save the auto industry.
If you are talking about the Wall Street bailout, where some of your friends destroyed this economy,
you know,
Donald Trump's calling on people to drop out, but you know, I think Donald suffered some real damage over the last week.
I'm sorry you guys had to wait. Let me say for the news media, this is effectively a rally in the middle of the night.
It's most likely that no one will have enough delegates. So we'll see, but it's a long way to go.
Uh-oh, we have another one. Get him out of here.
Sanders versus Trump does a lot better than Clinton versus Trump.
There's only one candidate in either party who has more votes than him, and that's me.
The simple reality is, you don't solve that anger by voting for a man who has been part of that corruption for the last 40 years.
Go home to mommy. Go home. Bye. Go home to mommy. Go home to mommy. Tell her to tuck you in bed.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. You recognize all those voices from the last couple of days. And if you need some comfort, some tucking in, join us. We'll protect you. Former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg surprised very few people yesterday by saying he won't jump into the 2016 presidential race. Bloomberg realizes what everybody else felt they already knew, that he can't win in a field with Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, and Hillary Clinton. Nevertheless, there's a fresh crop of primaries today. Republicans vote in a primary in Idaho, where 32 delegates are up for grabs, and they caucus in Hawaii. Democrats and Republicans alike also vote in open primaries today in Mississippi and in Michigan. Michigan is the big prize of the day, of course, 130 delegates at stake for the Democrats and 59 up for grabs for the Republicans, who are counting every single delegate on the road to Cleveland in a potentially contested primary. Michigan voters head to the polls today, and two of them join me now. Christopher Taylor is the Democratic mayor of Ann Arbor, Michigan, and Linda Lee Tarver is the president of the Republican Women's Federation of Michigan. Linda Lee told me why she's still strongly behind Florida Senator Marco Rubio.
He has an accomplished record. He supports Israel. He's pro-life. He's conservative, and I appreciate that about him.
Mayor Chris Taylor, you're on the Democratic side, and one thing that's striking about this race, the Democrats were in Flint, Michigan just the other night debating a lot of issues specific to Michigan, infrastructure, manufacturing jobs, of course, the water crisis in Flint. How critical has the Flint water crisis itself been to how Democratic voters, do you think, are behaving in Ann Arbor or in your state? Is it just one issue of many, or is it sort of the issue for Michiganders now?
On the state level, it is certainly where we are putting a lot of focus. We have our own water concerns here in Ann Arbor with the Gelman Plume. The provision of basic services by government, the provision of safe water, regulation of the environment, protection of the environment, these are things that everyone here in Ann Arbor certainly is very focused on, and I think throughout the state as well.
Now, Mayor Taylor, you're a college town, of course, right? University of Michigan,
right,
there in Ann Arbor. Probably a lot of Bernie supporters on the Democratic side in town, in the bars, in the sub shops, and in the bookstores, I would take it.
That's exactly right. It's a town where, you know, both Secretary Clinton and Senator Sanders have a great deal of support.
And what about you?
Well, for me, I'm really proud of the conversation and the discourse we are having on the Democratic side. You know, I don't think it's right to normalize the sort of thing we're seeing on the Republican side of the ticket. The president, the commander-in-chief, the head of state, is a position of dignity. It's a position where you need someone with a level head. You need someone who is going to present themselves to the nation and the world in a manner that creates pride in our country. And I think that's what you're seeing on the Democratic side.
All right, but I didn't hear an endorsement there from the mayor of Ann Arbor.
I'm getting there.
Okay.
There's a lot. I think there's a lot to love in both our candidates. But I'm going to supporting Secretary Clinton.
Fair enough. Linda Lee Tarver, you heard Mayor Taylor there sort of talk about the difference in tone between the two sides. Maybe you see it differently, but do you agree as a Michigander also that the Republican debate has been largely nationalized, almost completely nationalized, not really focused on the different states, including Michigan?
Absolutely, it's nationalized. They're not running for governor of the state of Michigan. We have a very effective, and I'm proud of our Governor Snyder here in Michigan. I'm proud of our Michigan Republican leadership. I am proud of what we're doing to respond to Flint, but they're not running for governor of Michigan or president of Michigan. They're running for president of the United States. And that's where they're supposed to be focused in on. It's great that Secretary Clinton will come in and use Flint as a campaign tool, but it's pandering and it's obvious. And I'm not impressed by it. She should focus in on the issues of which we are electing. With respect to the dignity and pride, there is no one on the Republican ticket, including the person that I'm supporting, Marco Rubio, that lacks any dignity or any candor or anything like that.
Oh, but Linda Lee, you can't possibly mean that. I know you support all the candidates to an extent, but please, I mean, you can't possibly say that Donald Trump's candidacy has been one of dignity. It has a lot of qualities,
I'm not saying that Donald Trump is performing his performance on the debate or on the campaign trail. He is clearly not a politician. He admits it so, but let's get real here. This man is the man of the deals. He is definitely a businessman and a very successful one. And you can argue with that if you want to, but going from 2 million to 40 billion is certainly a significant increase in wealth, and that takes a lot of dignity if you want to look at it that way. So no, I'm not going to take a person's attitude and their discussions and their tone on a campaign trail as how they would lead a country and whether they would represent us well.
Mayor Taylor, Linda Lee is correct that we're electing a national president on national issues. At the same time, Flint water aside, Michigan really continues to be sort of ground zero for a lot of the national economic debate that's going on. Exporting of jobs, infrastructure, free trade, all of these things have hit the bullseye in Michigan. So it's like national kind of is local there.
I think that's exactly correct. And I think that's why the conversation about what's going on in Flint and here in Michigan is perfectly appropriate for a national campaign. It provides a point of entry into these very important conversations about the role of government in our society. I believe that our government is us, and we need to respect it and have faith in it and support the work that government does and understand that it is honorable to provide services. It is honorable to regulate and protect the environment. It's honorable to invest in infrastructure, and it's honorable to have a government that respects itself enough to do these things well and with diligence. That's why talking about Flint and the troubles in Michigan is appropriate, because it is a reflection on how the candidates and we ourselves approach the role of government, and that's a national question.
Linda Lee Tarver, go right ahead.
Hillary Clinton is not addressing the EPA failures of Obama, of President Obama. She's not addressing the national issues and the national failures as an African-American woman. I can tell you that African-Americans under his watch in the last lost decade of Obama, we have not thrived in our nation because of the national issues. And because of that, she's unable to discuss the issues that are important to us. Yes, we need to have that discussion. But to talk about Flint and to traipse out a few people from a black church is pandering. And I'm sorry, it is pandering.
Mayor Taylor, go ahead.
Sure. I think that come November, African Americans of the United States will vote with their feet and demonstrate where they fall on that statement.
Well, I'm an African American woman. I can tell you right now my family's voting for, that are Democrats, are voting for Bernie Sanders. They don't have faith in Hillary Clinton. As a woman, I would never vote for Hillary Clinton. She is pandering to the people, and I'm sorry, she is not qualified to be president, in my opinion.
I hear you saying that, but I think that you'll see the facts on the ground demonstrate that the vast majority of African-Americans who vote in this country think otherwise.
Linda Lee Tarver, you support Marco Rubio, but as you know, his prospects are getting kind of dim. If he doesn't win in Florida, his candidacy may be over. And there's now open talk in your party, not just among journalists like me, of a contested convention, that it might be the only way for the party to derail Donald Trump. Mitt Romney is one person who's asking voters like you and other Republicans in Michigan to vote strategically, that Republicans in Ohio should vote John Kasich, that Republicans in Florida should vote Marco Rubio, all for the purposes of keeping Donald Trump out of office. This is part of the calculation now that Republicans like you have to make, even if Marco Rubio is your guy.
I'm as conservative as they get here in Michigan. I am a non-traditional Republican voter and Republican Party, face of the Republican Party. And I'm supporting Marco Rubio, but I support any candidate who gets the nomination for my party. And I'm not trying to be strategic on his campaign. I like Marco Rubio. I think that he would be the best president for us. But I also like Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, Governor Kasich. I like the candidates that we have over the candidates that the Democratic Party are offering to us. And because of that, I'm not going to get engaged with derailing Mr. Trump's opportunities. But if he doesn't get to 1237, that's the number of delegates that are required. He's almost at 381 or 384 right now. That's a long time between 384 and 1237. If he earns them, then he deserves the nomination. If he doesn't, then we'll see him in Cleveland.
Mayor Chris Taylor heading to the polls today. Democrats across Michigan, final thoughts.
I think that it's a Democratic year. I think Democrats are excited about their candidates and proud of the conversation we're having and looking forward to November.
That's Mayor Chris Taylor of the college town of Ann Arbor, Michigan, a Democrat. Also Linda Lee Tarver, president of the Republican Women's Federation of Michigan, a Marco Rubio supporter. Thank you both so much.
Thank you so much.
150 people were killed in U.S. airstrikes over the weekend in Somalia. The Pentagon says that a drone hit an al-Shabaab training camp where a large-scale attack was being planned. U.S. planes also involved in that attack. The Pentagon also says it believes that everyone killed in the strike were terrorist fighters. The Obama administration has relied heavily on the use of drones to take out what it claims are suspected terrorists. Lisa Monaco at the White House, the president's counterterrorism and homeland security advisor, said that the White House will now disclose annually how many people have been killed by U.S. drones since 2009, including civilians.
Not only is greater transparency the right thing to do, it is the best way to maintain the legitimacy of our counterterrorism actions and the broad support of our allies.
Now, it's important to note that the new policy will not cover active hostilities in places like Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan. It only includes strikes in nations like Pakistan, Libya, Yemen, and, of course, Somalia. Joining me now is Michael Hayden. He was director of the National Security Agency from 1999 until 2005 and director of the CIA from 2006 until 2009. He has a new book out. It's called Playing to the Edge, American Intelligence in the Age of Terror. General Hayden, welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much, Todd. Happy to be here.
That strike in Somalia, 150 fighters killed, according to the Pentagon. Any strategic importance here or just another tactical gain in the war on terror?
No, it's an important tactical gain, but I think it's a tactical gain. It doesn't change the facts on the ground, but it makes us safer for the moment and actually creates some space so that policymakers can continue to do what they have to do eventually, which is to change the reality of the threat against us.
Now, we've learned in recent years about how the military and the CIA and the president himself go about choosing targets for drone strikes. What will we learn now from the new disclosures that Lisa Monaco and the White House is saying it's going to make on an annual basis?
Well, first of all, I was delighted that Lisa made that announcement. It's been hard for folks like me who actually have some real-world experience when it comes to the targeted killing program. It's been hard to try to justify the program in public since, frankly, we've been limited in what it is we can say about it. And so we have the claims made by the groups that you suggested are trying to follow this, which, frankly, the more extreme claims they make are not consistent with any of my life experience. But now we've got real numbers to put out there. Look, Todd, this is controversial. There aren't many governments who agree with our legal theory in terms of using targeted killings outside of the internationally agreed theaters of conflict. And so if we want legitimacy domestically and with our friends, we're just going to have to be more transparent about it.
There's a quote that's now getting kind of famous from you, General Hayden, in 2014 that says the reliance on air power has all the attraction of casual sex. It seems to offer gratification, but with very little commitment. And we need to be wary of a strategy that puts emphasis on air power and air power alone. Do you stand by that statement? And do these disclosures bring maybe a different calculation to how committed you are to the attraction of drone strikes?
Yeah, actually, that quote, and it is an accurate quote, Todd, was directed specifically at our efforts against ISIS in Iraq and Syria. And there, the nature of the problem is such that no one with any experience in these kinds of matters thinks that we can defeat ISIS with air power alone. This is a necessary, but I would admit, Todd, insufficient action on our part. My last week in government, I was on the margins of an NSC meeting. Rahm Emanuel, then the White House Chief of Staff, thanked me for something I had briefed on the margins of the meeting, an operational success. I said, Rahm, thank you very much. That's kind of you to congratulate us on that. But you realize, Rahm, if we don't change the facts on the ground, we get to kill these people forever. And my point being that that's not a successful strategy.
General Michael Hayden, part of your book tour the last couple of weeks has been going after Donald Trump for his rhetoric on the campaign trail, saying that he would bring back waterboarding, saying that he'd be willing to target the families of terrorists and other civilians. These things, of course, are war crimes and are illegal. You seem to have gotten to him. Donald Trump now says in his speeches that he has to stay within the law. But then I noticed kind of a wink and a nod to his raucous crowds that he's going to stay within the law, but ISIS doesn't stay within the law, so I'm going to do what I have to do.
Yeah, there's a lack of clarity. You had the, frankly, outrageous comments at the debate last Thursday. Look, Todd, my book's called Playing to the Edge. And so, frankly, I think I've had to defend myself against being very aggressive. But the title implies, in fact, it states that there is an edge, that there are limits. And some of the rhetoric coming out of Mr. Trump was well beyond any edge that a civilized nation should accept.
And still, you're acknowledging with your book title and your reference to it that there are edges you cannot cross. Maybe Donald Trump has, but there are millions of people who think that you crossed it long ago and that President Obama did too.
Fully agreed. And that's the debate of a free people. So if we can just imagine a table in front of us, Todd, there are some things off here to one side that no one could possibly think would be acceptable. And there are some things over here on the other side that no one could argue against. And then you got most of the rest of the things you have as options. And those things are in what I try to describe in the book is an infinite gray zone in which you're trying to balance things, frankly, Todd, that are virtues, liberty, security, privacy, safety. But in the real world, you have to make choices. And how you balance what is the correct choice for that moment depends on the totality of circumstances in which you find yourself. And as a free people, we argue about that.
One also hopes that as Americans go out to presidential campaign rallies, regardless of which one they're going to, that they're getting at least some version of a nuanced view of this complex problem, regardless of whether they think Michael Hayden acted responsibly or not. Michael Hayden is former director of the National Security Agency and former director of the CIA. His new book is called Playing to the Edge, American Intelligence in the Age of Terror. General Hayden, thanks again.
Thank you, Todd.
We go to California now, where drought, of course, is the big problem. But over the last couple of weeks, it's been the opposite. Heavy storms have been pummeling that state with much-needed rainwater. That's good news for the drought-stricken region, but in Los Angeles, most of that storm water, it runs right off into the ocean. L.A. City officials like Marty Adams, though, they're trying to change that. Instead of routing the rainwater away, doesn't it make more sense to capture it? Marty is Senior Assistant General Manager with the L.A. Department of Water and Power. He says that one obstacle is that L.A. was specifically designed over the last several decades to divert that storm water into the ocean in order to avoid terrible floods. So a citywide effort to do the opposite is a huge undertaking.
We're looking at a situation where we've got to capture the water pretty much before it gets into the storm channels, because once it's there, it's on a fast path to the ocean. And so we want to try to catch it on property, on private property or public property, and really stop it and slow it down from actually getting into the streets and getting into the storm drains. And that's a big challenge.
How do you do that?
You know, we have a couple of large basins that we've spread water in already, and those have been there since the 1940s, particularly in the San Fernando Valley. But at this point, you know, you can't go out and buy a large property and clear it of buildings waiting for it to rain. And so there's really not a lot of opportunities for big stormwater capture. So what we really have to do is have a lot of small projects. And so we are doing things on some of our streets. We're doing some places where in the parkways, instead of them running off into the street, we do a swale so the water can collect, or in a street median. We're doing work in our public parks to try to lower the grass level, so instead of the stormwater running off, it actually kind of pools and collects there. Sometimes in streets we put what we call dry wells, which are places that water can infiltrate and not continue to run down the gutter. But ultimately, I think we're going to have to get on private property. There's only so much public property we can use. We basically have to get people to hold water in their properties, on their yards, and not have it run off so fast.
Well, is the idea then, if you're encouraging people to hold it on their own private property, modify that backyard or their storm gutters a little bit, to hold it on the property and use it in your own house, or to feed it back into the public supply? How does that work?
Well, you know, we have a program right now for rain barrels. They're like 55-gallon drums. Some look like drums. Some look pretty fancy, like big urns. And that would collect water off people's roofs down their gutters. And those kind of projects, people can then use that in their gardens during the course of the year. And then we're trying to grow that into what we call cisterns, which are basically larger capture facilities. And those, at this point, would help people offset their water use by allowing them to use that water outdoors. But ultimately, you know, the big benefit is to try to get more water into the ground, because there's only so much stormwater you can use on your property. But if we can slow it down by any of these methods to capture it and have it soak into the ground, it'll eventually become drinking water supply.
Okay, that all sounds great. So what is L.A. County or the other jurisdictions around the San Fernando Valley, around the area there in Southern California, what are they doing to give people an incentive to get these urns, to do all these things that help keep the water on the ground and then into the ground more efficiently?
So, you know, there are a number of agencies involved. Every city has its own runoff issues to deal with. L.A. County is a big player because they have, you know, regional control over stormwater. And then through the local wholesaler, Metropolitan Water District, there's actually a rebate program. And they'll rebate $75 a rain barrel and up to 4 rain barrels. So that's a good amount of money. It almost offsets the whole cost. And then in the city of Los Angeles, we actually add money on top of that.
Marty Adams, you know what you need?
What's that?
Your former governor famously sped around those storm drains on a motorcycle in Terminator 2. Great scene. You need the former governor to turn to the camera and say, get your cistern.
That's a good idea.
Marty Adams is Senior Assistant General Manager with the L.A. Department of Water and Power. Thanks, Marty.
Thank you very much.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program, performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org.
This Civil Rights Act is a challenge to all of us to go to work in our communities and our states, in our homes and in our hearts, to eliminate the last vestiges of injustice in our beloved country.
That's President Lyndon Johnson signing the Civil Rights Act into law on July 2nd, 1964. That law banned public and workplace discrimination because of race or because of national origin or because of religion. It also banned discrimination because of sex, and that last-minute addition to the bill was largely thanks to a segregationist Virginia congressman named Howard Smith. Now, Howard Smith added the ban on sex discrimination to what is now known as Title VII of the law. Some historians think Smith's addition was actually a joke. He was pretty sarcastic about it at the time. Others say he was worried about white women losing jobs to blacks who would have new access to the workplace. But whatever his reasons, Title VII and those three words in it, because of sex, have transformed the role of women in the workplace over the last 50-plus years in this country. Author Jillian Thomas chronicles that change in her new book out today. It's called Because of Sex, One Law, 10 Cases in 50 Years That Changed American Women's Lives at Work. And she says that the law faced its first real test in the late 60s, thanks to a Florida waitress who wanted a better job.
Ida Phillips was a mother of seven children and was married, but it was an unhappy marriage, and her husband was not, to say the least, a contributor to the family. So she worked as a waitress, but she heard from her next-door neighbor that they were hiring down at the assembly line at Martin Marietta, the defense contractor, and that the wages would be vastly greater than what she was making as a waitress and also came with benefits. So she drove down. There was an ad in the paper, and she drove down, and the receptionist wouldn't even hand her an application because she first asked Ms. Phillips, do you have any children who are preschool age? And Ms. Phillips did have a five-year-old daughter, her youngest, Gracie. And so she answered that she did. And the receptionist wouldn't even give her an application because she said the company won't hire women with children that young. They'll hire men, but not women. And so she came home and she sat down at her kitchen table and wrote a letter to Lyndon Johnson. And that letter to Lyndon B. Johnson ended up getting forwarded to the EEOC, which is the start of the filing process for a federal lawsuit. She teamed up with an African-American lawyer, very young, just out of law school, named Reese Marshall. They lost at the district court level and appealed to the Fifth Circuit, and the Fifth Circuit endorsed the company's assumption that underlay its policy, which is that, well, of course, mothers are going to be less dependable workers, and we don't think Congress intended to undermine that assumption or not let employers make that assumption. Finally, Reese Marshall was able to get some prominent national groups involved in the case, which he had not been able to up until that time. And the NAACP Legal Defense Fund was able to see that even though Ida Phillips was a white woman, that it was mostly black women who were mothers and in the workforce, and that this policy very directly affected the population they cared about most.
Well, Ida Phillips won in the Supreme Court and instantly became something of a pioneer of these sex discrimination cases. But Jillian Thomas, in the end, what did she get for her victory?
She got very little, which is sadly the case so often. The company did eventually agree to settle, and after the Supreme Court victory, because the company was able to produce evidence showing that if she had been hired way back when she first applied, that her position would have suffered a layoff. So all told, I think she got something around $15,000, and she gave some of it to her oldest daughter to buy a house. She took Gracie, the cause of the whole lawsuit, took her to Disney World, and then she bought herself an air conditioner, which was the first one she'd ever had all her years living in Florida.
Well, there were no women on the court when this case was decided, of course. And reading through the book, it made me wonder how the profile of these cases have changed over the last couple of decades as women slowly started to join the court and help crafting the decisions. How have these cases changed since that era began?
You're absolutely right. I mean, at the time Title VII was enacted, there were almost no women on the federal bench across the country, let alone on the Supreme Court. Sandra Day O'Connor was on the court when the first sexual harassment case came to the court, and it's obvious from the questioning that she did from the bench that she knew something about this issue that the men on that court did not know. And that certainly has proceeded. In the more recent cases, the court has been rather tough on Title VII plaintiffs, and we've, as a result, seen a number of very impassioned dissents from Ruth Bader Ginsburg, especially.
So you mentioned that Title VII cases have had some setbacks in front of the court in the last several years. Is there a way to describe what the ceiling or the limits of Title VII have become now in the interpretation of just how much women can ask for in terms of equal treatment under the law?
Well, I will say, as a caveat to my prior point, the one area in which Title VII cases have really been expansively read by the court is in the area of retaliation. And one of the cases in the book, the Burlington Northern case, was decided in 2006, and it was the first time the court had addressed retaliation. And since that time, they have been extremely expansive in protections for people who complain about discrimination or help their colleagues complain about discrimination. But the other changes that I've seen in the area of sexual harassment, for instance, that the law has developed in such a way that the judicial inquiry is much more focused on how did the victim of the harassment react? Did she make it obvious and openly understood that she did not welcome it? There's this standard of having to show that it was unwelcome harassment. And then she has to show that she utilized every possible mechanism for complaining. Those are obviously common sense notions that if someone's harassing you, you should do your best to make it stop. But the way this is played out in the courts is that it ends up being rather punitive, and a lot of the focus of the analysis is not on what the harassment was or what the employer did to try to stop it, but what the victim did to try to stop it herself.
Jillian Thomas is author of Because of Sex, One Law, 10 Cases in 50 Years That Changed American Women's Lives at Work. Jillian Thomas, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you today. You know, women are not alone in their experience of prejudice in the workplace. You don't have to go very far back, only to the spring of 2007, to find another glaring example of exclusion. The presidential campaign was just getting underway at the time. Legal gay marriage was only on the books in two states. Also that spring, Lord Brown was CEO of BP, one of the largest oil companies in the world, and he resigned in a scandal. A British tabloid published a story of an encounter with another man, and Lord Brown had to step down as CEO after 12 years on the job. Now, gay marriage is legal nationwide. The world's most valuable company, Apple, is run by an openly gay man, Tim Cook, and Lord Brown is back in the boardroom as executive chairman of L1 Energy, an oil and gas investment company. Now, while Apple's profits are soaring, the price of oil is in the tank, below $40 a barrel. A lot has changed since 2007, and John Brown is here. He's author of the new book, Connect: How Companies Succeed by Engaging Radically. Now, we're going to talk about his book on changing how corporations engage with society and see how much corporate culture is ready to change, and talk about some other things too. Lord Brown, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
Things have changed radically in some ways since 2007.
Oh, definitely. Certainly, it's very good to see Tim Cook as the only openly gay CEO in the Fortune 100, perhaps even in the S&P 500. I think I'm the other one, but I'm retired from that set. But lots changed in that and in the way in which companies look at various all the things they do and how people look at companies.
Did you ever feel like, you know, given the timeline that I just gave, which is a mystery to no one, that you missed the mark by just a couple of years of society, or the conversation about being gay in the workplace or gay at all had been just a couple of years earlier, you'd still be at the helm of BP?
Well, it's not easy being an openly gay CEO. Otherwise, I think we'd see more. If there's only one openly gay CEO in the S&P 500, that I think would be statistically improbable. Something's not quite set yet at the top of companies. What is good is a lot's going on in companies which is making the glass half full. People are able to be themselves, and that's important for productivity, engagement, and also it's just right that people can be themselves.
Now, let's talk about the book a little bit, because you want corporations themselves to sort of change who they are as they relate to society. You say American corporations, or all corporations, need to find radical new ways to engage the public with social responsibility. What do you mean by that? And let's avoid sort of – there's a lot of corporate buzzwords that I'm aware of. What is radical? What does that really mean?
Simply engage on the terms that society wants you to engage on, not on your agenda. So it's what people want from you, not what you want to give them. And that is important, because so much of this is a dialogue which goes right over the top of people's heads. They get it right for customers, but then for communities, for regulators, there's a dialogue which doesn't make sense.
I mean, the entire capitalist corporate system is not set up with an incentive structure that aligns with what you're talking about. We have an entire structure that famously, I'll just say, is profit over people. We expect corporations to behave that way. That's why we have regulation. We expect corporations to run roughshod, and we regulate them so that they don't hurt people. That's a simplistic view. You're calling for something completely different.
Let me pare it back a couple of ways. First, I think regulation is something which is given, which allows people to do business and be trusted. Nobody trusts a businessman who says, I'm going to do something. They might, but actually they'd much prefer to trust someone who's independent. Regulation is about that independence, and it's about doing the right thing for everybody. In history, it's always been the case. You know, Mr. Heinz, when he was doing ketchup, he had the unique idea of making ketchup out of tomatoes, and everybody else was making it out of rubbish. He got regulations set up so that he could do his business and be trusted as someone who's doing what he said he's going to do. So I think regulation is very important. But society does have an incentive to punish business. If you look at what Volkswagen has done recently, look what happened to their stock price. It went down 30%, went down even more, because they broke a bond of trust. This is about not engaging with society in the way they want to have companies engage. And in my book, I talk very much about the risk of companies not engaging properly. It's a very big value risk. Their stock price goes down when they break that bond. And in the reverse, when they do it well, they make returns which are much higher than everybody else. So there really is an incentive, an economic incentive, to get this right. It's about engaging openly, transparently, on the terms that society wants you to engage in.
And you think that the fundamental incentives of how corporations engage with the public now are ready for that? I mean, we have a system now. There are cases like Volkswagen, like you say, where companies are punished by share price or by consumers for doing the wrong thing. And you and I can sit here for the next 4 hours and talk about the examples where doing the wrong thing paid off because you paid a fine or didn't get caught at all. The fine was the cost of doing business, and you just soldier on with profit over people.
Less and less, I believe, because reputations of companies and their ability to do to have customers, to have a point at which they're trusted, is damaged when, in effect, the punishment doesn't fit the crime. And so I think that what's different today is that everybody knows so much more about what everybody's doing. It's called transparency and it's called communication. So everybody knows it, and in the past they didn't. I mean, when I started in business, which was a little while ago, people actually trusted authority. You know, when someone would come out and say something, they would say, an interviewer would say virtually to a chief executive officer, is there any more wisdom you wish to impart to your audience? Quite the reverse now.
We're in the midst of a presidential election. Before I let you go, Lord Brown, as you know, one of the strains of this election is the corporations have bared down on us. They've ruined society in so many ways, the financial collapse. Tax them, push them to the ground, get them out of the way. You're preaching something different, and it may fall on some skeptical ears.
Well, I hope not, because there are real examples in history when corporations were punished so badly, it damaged the future prosperity and happiness of everybody. So this is something which needs to be avoided by corporations doing a different thing, not soft-soaping people, but actually radically changing the way in which they think about their business to the core. And that's what this book is about.
Lord Brown, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
John Brown is former CEO of BP. He is author of Connect: How Companies Succeed by Engaging Radically. And here's something to take with you today. A little bit of history. March 8th is International Women's Day, celebrated the world over. But the idea actually has its roots in Russia's communist revolution. I wonder what Lord Brown would think of that. Russian Marxists first celebrated what they called the Day of International Solidarity among the female proletariat on today's date, back in 1913. So everybody celebrate, whether you're Russian, Marxist, American, Trumpian, or capitalist. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And LegalZoom, supporting small business owners across America for over 10 years, with services including business formations and corporate filings, plus independent professionals providing contract review and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org. And from Staples, with printer ink and toner cartridges for home or business printers, and in-store print shops that can create customized presentations, booklets, and manuals at Staples Stores or Staples.com. Staples, make more happen. Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program. Performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. TIAA Cref, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.